My own journey with Sjogren's disease began in 2002. I was playing professionally and I remember feeling this extreme fatigue. I actually thought I had mono, but there was one day in particular at a training session when we were playing a small-sided game that I felt like my legs were stuck in quicksand. I immediately knew something was wrong. The next couple of weeks I spent going to different doctors. My last doctor's appointment, they did a test where they put two small pieces of paper in my eyes to see how much tears I would produce. At the end of the test, the papers were completely dry. The doctor explained that I had Sjogren's, and my first reaction was, what is Sjogren's?
That's three-time Olympian gold medalist and World Cup soccer champion Shannon Box describing her diagnosis of Sjogren's disease. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Named after an early 20th century Swedish ophthalmologist, Sjogren's syndrome is an autoimmune disorder known for causing chronic dry eyes and dry mouth, among other symptoms. My guest specializes in this disorder and is doing groundbreaking trials testing new treatments. Sarah McCoy has both her MD and PhD and is a faculty member in UW's Division of Rheumatology within the Department of Medicine. She is a clinical rheumatologist and the director of the UW Health Sjogren's Clinic. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you for having me on today, Emily.
You know, I had coworkers sitting around a table, and when I said I'm going to be doing a show about Sjogren's, the response I got was, what's that? And only one of the five had heard of it. Yet it does affect millions. So if Sjogren's does affect a lot of people, why have most of us not heard of it?
Sjogren's, we think, is much more common than research is able to identify. And the reason is because the primary symptom is dry eye and dry mouth. And that is a ubiquitous symptom. So dentists see it all the time and usually don't comment on it unless there's something extreme like a lot of recurrent cavities. And ophthalmologists see it all the time as well. Because it's so ubiquitous, roughly 30% of the population has a dry eye or dry mouth at some point. To tie it to Sjogren's disease, which is common but a little less common, is not usually in the top of the mind of most providers. So one of the pushes of the Sjogren Foundation and others in the field is to try to increase recognition, especially because the landscape is changing in the disease and we're expanding our therapeutic options.
You know, it's one of many autoimmune disorders within the field of rheumatology that you're in. I'm just curious, what drew you to the field of rheumatology to begin with? You could have gone into pulmonology, pediatrics, you know, so many other areas, cardiology. What made rheumatology seem like something you wanted to spend your life studying?
I think I was the only child who wanted to be a rheumatologist. So I had JIA when I was a kid.
And
juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And it was JRA at the time, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And I had rheumatologists in upstate New York where I was, and they were excellent. And so I grew up wanting to be like them. I was the only one in my medical school class who wanted to be a rheumatologist.
That makes sense. I often find when I ask people why they went into something, there's a connection. Maybe their mother had something, or maybe they witnessed something or experienced it, and it made them passionate about that field. Within the area of rheumatology, like what falls in that category?
A bunch of autoimmune diseases. And it depends sort of where you are, what sort of diseases are seen by a rheumatologist. But certainly things that fall under the spectrum of connective tissue diseases, such as lupus, as you mentioned, myositis, systemic sclerosis, those are all diseases that fall into rheumatology. Gout is another disease that many of us see. And then there's a category called the spondyloarthropathies, which are diseases like ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic arthritis, which is related to psoriasis and quite common, and diseases associated with bowel inflammation as well. We sometimes see forms of osteoarthritis or other joint disease because we are really familiar with the joints because so many of our diseases affect the joints. So that's sort of the bread and butter of day-to-day rheumatology.
Within that area, then, what made you particularly interested in Sjogren's?
Sjogren's disease is one of the few diseases of the many we just mentioned that has really no effective treatments available. And when you see these patients, so as a provider of any kind or a physician, you get into this field really because you just want to help. You want to help people. And I found it demoralizing for both the patient and myself to not have much to offer. And we I don't know if I mentioned this to you over email, but we really have not advanced our therapeutics significantly since the 1800s. When the first patient was described in the literature with what we think is Sjogren's
disease. That's kind of sad, isn't it?
Oh, it's so sad. I mean, 1888, one of the first cases of Sjogren was described. And this woman had a tongue that was dry and cracked in all directions like crocodile skin. She couldn't cry, tears. She had trouble speaking. And this woman was treated with a tincture of a Jabirondi plant, which is today's modern day best treatment for dryness. And so that shows you how little we've advanced. And I think it's that lack of being able to help and be proactive that drove me to specifically research and see Sjogren patients so that I could do something active, because it makes you feel better. I think to be active about making a situation better, at least for me, that's how I feel. And so I like to take an active role in a disease process that needs some help. And that's really where Sjogren was at the time.
If you're trying to describe what an autoimmune disease is, because we've got Sjogren's, but as you mentioned, there's also lupus, connective tissue diseases. Can you give us some sense of, you know, obviously we're sort of attacking our own immune system, but how does that work, this group of diseases where you're attacking your own body?
So an autoimmune disease is self-immunity. So what you can think of it as, there's some sort of trigger, and your immune system, which should only recognize foreign pathogens, right? It should recognize an infection like the flu or a bacterial infection, and it should fight off that infection. That's what your immune system is built to do. But in autoimmunity, it goes haywire, and instead it recognizes yourself as foreign, and it attacks your own body. And that's what generates this auto or self immunity. And it can manifest in many ways. And those are the diseases we mentioned, things like lupus, like systemic sclerosis, like myositis. All of those are inflammatory autoimmune diseases where your immune system attacks self in different ways.
The way I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, I have connective tissue disease, came when I was bitten by a tick that was carrying Lyme disease. And the reaction, which was this bullseye rash, happened so quickly that Dr. Mackey in infectious disease said, get an ANA done, because that looks like an autoimmune response for it to respond so quickly. But what are some of the tests that you would do? You have a patient who comes, has dry eyes, dry mouth, maybe is aching. What are some of the standard things that you would do to figure out what it is?
Yeah, so we have a very nice diagnostic algorithm is what I would call it, where we work through this process that helps us diagnose the disease. And in Sjogren disease specifically, it's very important because, again, that dryness is so ubiquitous. So we start off with asking a series of questions that actually have been around since the 1980s. It takes a few seconds. I mean, it tells us if you're dry enough, are we concerned about Sjogren disease? And those questions are six, so I'll run through them. They don't take very long. So one is, have you had a daily persistent dry mouth for the last few months? So it shouldn't just be a few days, right? It's a chronic,
it's chronic
disease.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Would you have difficulty with swallowing a saltine? Would you have to take a sip of water? Have you ever had salivary gland enlargement? It's kind of like the glands right by your ear. It can make you look like a chipmunk.
Is that the lymph nodes?
It's actually the salivary glands. So we have lymph nodes in our neck, and then we have these glands responsible for making saliva. We actually have six of them that are large, and then we have 1,000 of them everywhere sprinkled that are small through our mouth. And then we have three eye questions. Have you had daily persistent dry eye, for more than 6 months? Do you have to use eye drops more than 3 times a day to wet your eye? Do you feel a sandy or gritty sensation in your eye when you wake up in the morning? And those questions alone, if you answer yes to them, tell us, okay, well, your dryness is pretty significant. Those patients then come into rheumatology or even can see their dentist or an ear, nose, and throat or an ophthalmologist. And we do objective testing to confirm those symptoms. And one is the unstimulated salivary flow, which sounds long and fancy, but it's drooling in a cup for 5 minutes.
So it's the quantity of saliva?
It's the quantity of saliva. Yeah. And I did that all through COVID, and we actually never had any problems.
I remember hearing from people who were trying to do that saliva test for COVID and having trouble producing. So maybe they had Sjogren's and didn't know it.
So I had to write a lot of excuse letters because our faculty had to do the saliva-based tests, and we couldn't make the full, I think it was almost a milliliter we needed to make. So I did have to write excuses during COVID. We do something called a Schirmer test, where we put a little strip of paper in the corner of the eye, and that quantifies tears. And then a special ophthalmologist, a cornea expert at University of Wisconsin, we have great ones, can do something called an ocular staining score that can actually quantify the amount of damage from dryness in the eye. Once we have that, if we're really dry objectively, so we've done subjective, meaning some symptoms, we've quantified the amount of tears or saliva, then we can move on to blood testing. And about 70% of Sjogren's disease patients will have a positive anti-SSA antibody.
What is that you just said about the antibody?
Good question. So that's a blood test that is pretty specific for Sjogren's disease. And of course, like most things, there are some nuances to it that I could wax on about for a long period of time. But it is fairly diagnostic for Sjogren's disease. And it not only is diagnostic, but patients who have this positive test look a little bit different than patients who are negative for the test.
You mean how so?
So they have a little bit of a different presentation. So they tend to have less severe dryness symptoms than patients who are blood test negative. And we could hypothesize as to why that might be, but we don't know yet. And they tend to have more severe organ involvement than patients who are SSA negative. And by organ involvement in Sjogren's disease, you can have a host of other places beyond the glands involved. Not in everybody. So everybody is pretty much dry who comes with Sjogren's disease to some extent. But a subset of those, up to 50%, have something else involved in their body. And that's one of my jobs, is to figure it out. And then the other 30% require tissue to diagnose them. So we specifically need tissue from a gland to see that there's active inflammation causing the dryness.
Like a biopsy?
A biopsy.
So you take a little piece of tissue and then study that. And when you do the biopsy, then what is it that you're seeing or looking at?
So we have excellent pathologists at University of Wisconsin who I get to work with. And we've together made sure that our scoring system is up to date. But essentially, we're looking at the gland tissue and we are seeing your immune cells attacking the gland. So we can directly visualize your immune cells involving the gland, and that's diagnostic for us. And it does it in a really unique way that's fascinating in that it attacks the gland in foci, like little areas of inflammation, and the rest of the gland is normal. And one of the great mysteries for us is if most of the gland looks normal and only some of it is attacked by your immune cells, why do we get so dry? And that is one of the many research items that we work on.
So as you're working on diagnosing people with Sjogren's syndrome, I guess you also probably are finding a lot of other things. So you don't have Sjogren's, but you have this other thing. What is the closest relationship? Is it lupus?
Well, I don't know if we can clearly say the closest relationship, but I will say among Sjogren's patients, there's a high amount of overlap with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. Those are probably the two most common overlap diseases. We also see associations with systemic sclerosis and myositis.
No, we opened with a clip from Shannon Box, and she was talking about having both lupus and Sjogren's and others too, where I think I saw a figure somewhere of maybe 50% of Sjogren's patients have another one too. That seems kind of unfair, doesn't it?
I know. Our patients deal with so much. But some of that, there's a question, too, of, did they have Sjogren's? Were they diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis first because their Sjogren manifested as joint pain, which is a feature of rheumatoid arthritis? There's also some artifact to that, too, because some of the we don't have FDA-approved disease-modifying therapy for Sjogren's disease. And frequently, we use therapies for rheumatoid arthritis if there's joint involvement in Sjogren, and so we code or bill for rheumatoid arthritis. So there's some nuance to that as well, but there is a fair amount of true overlap where people have multiple diseases. Some of it, like I said, is just a little bit of an artifact.
Let's talk about the demographics. I think I read somewhere, it might have been on the Mayo Clinic site, that there's something like a 10-to-1 ratio of women to men.
We believe it's one of the most female-predominant systemic autoimmune diseases. And uniquely so. Why is that? We have a lot of hypotheses, but we haven't nailed it down. So we have found some X-linked associations. So this exist phenomenon is a potential explanatory variable. The other things, it might relate to our hormones. So it's really interesting because there's two peaks of onset most women get Sjogren's disease around the time of menopause, perimenopausal. But there's a smaller subset that get it around the time of menarche, when they start having periods. And so we do think there's a hormone component to this as well. So we have X chromosome, we have maybe some hormones, those two features make us think maybe, you know, there's some sort of link to the fact that we're female, but we haven't nailed down exactly why that might be.
If women evolutionarily and so on are built to have a foreign body, a baby, and not react to that, you'd think you would have fewer cases of autoimmune disease in a certain way. Is it somewhat related at all, or is it like it's just not known, but something about those hormones that go a little haywire, or?
Yeah, if we knew, then we could advise people better, right? But we usually don't know. And sometimes in pregnancy, our patients actually can get a little bit worse. So Sjogren's disease, we mentioned lupus a little bit, but it can sometimes be a bit of a sliding scale. So their diagnostic classification criteria overlap a fair amount because their features overlap. So when my Sjogren patients get pregnant, I actually monitor them for the development of lupus just to be on the safe side. You're right. Does that make sense? I don't know. But some can sort of flip into more of a lupus phenotype or appearance when they have those huge hormone shifts. Why does a human body do that? It shouldn't, you would think, right? You don't want to detect self or non-self when you're pregnant, but it does. And actually, our Sjogren patients who are pregnant need special monitoring and intervention. So it's important to identify it early if you can.
What role do viruses play in sort of triggering flare-ups or the onset of something? And I guess it's a two-part question, because could it be that people have actually been carrying whatever is going to turn into Sjogren's since childhood or since birth, but it just gets activated either with a hormonal change or with a virus or something that's like an on switch?
So we follow sort of a hypothesis that there are two hits. And the first is that you're born with a genetic predisposition of varying strength. And we do have some understanding of that. OMRF has done really great genome-wide association studies. And so we know some candidate genes, but not everybody, even in twin studies, each twin doesn't get Sjogren's disease. So it's not just genetics. There is a second hit. And we think that second hit is viral or something related. And that's our strongest contender for a second hit. And a lot of viruses actually like to live in the salivary glands. And so we think that you're infected by a virus and it lives in the gland and it can really flare your disease. Actually, just recently, Blake Warner at NIDCR, which is our institute at the National Institute of Health, published finding that COVID likes to replicate and stay in the salivary glands. So we think there's a second hit of some kind, and that's what brings on your disease. And then you add to that whole amalgamation of factors, hormone shifts, and it becomes quite complicated.
And do you find that Sjogren's runs in families? In other words, if you have somebody who has Sjogren's, is she likely to have an aunt, a mother, sister that also has it?
I don't know if it's a Wisconsin or Madison thing, but I follow several families of Sjogren's disease patients. And if they're listening, thank you for all your contributions to my research, because most of the families are pretty enthusiastic about helping us understand Sjogren's disease. But it certainly can run in families.
Like with twins, where only one sort of expresses it. But I guess, does the other twin also have it sort of in a dormant form?
Right. And it depends on the amount of that genetic, of those genes they have, the burden of the genes that predispose them. And so in the families, we tend to have a stronger genetic component than in individuals who don't have a family history of Sjogren's disease.
We're going to talk more about Sjogren's when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Hey everyone, so today I wanted to talk about something that affects not only me personally, but lots of people, and that's chronic illness. In 2011, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease called Sjogren's syndrome. Now, Sjogren's syndrome is one of many, many, many autoimmune diseases, and we're seeing people get diagnosed more frequently than ever right now. So you may be familiar with some other autoimmune diseases, for example, like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. There are quite a few. So it's not uncommon for people to face these challenges. And today I wanted to talk about what my journey is or has been, and also different ways to deal with chronic illness. So even though some people may not have an autoimmune disease, you may be dealing with chronic illness. And these are illnesses defined that illnesses that you're living with on a long-term basis. So I live with Sjogren's syndrome every day, and I have continued to find a way to make a life and make a career and make the best life out of it. It isn't always easy, but that's a part of the challenge. And I wanted to talk about this and share all of this with you today.
That's Venus Williams talking about her journey with Sjogren's disease. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Dr. Sarah McCoy, and we are talking about the autoimmune disease Sjogren's, which turns out to be more common than we think, yet not that widely known about. You mentioned that one of the problems is that dry eyes and dry mouth are so common, and it's certainly true. If you go to a drugstore, there's a whole shelf full of eye drops you can buy over the counter and eye compresses and everything else. I've also noticed in the ads for various medications, you know how they tell you how wonderful it is, but then there's this whole thing at the bottom about how you could get kidney failure and die. And almost all of the drugs use will tell you the side effect can include dry mouth, dry eyes. Are medications sometimes, would they give you a false sense that you might have? Like if somebody's listening and they think, oh no, I have dry eyes and dry mouth, I might have Sjogren's. Could it be a side effect from medications they're on, or just aging, or you know how medical students think they're getting every disease they read about? How would someone who suffers from dry eyes and dry mouth know, you know what, this is just a symptom of something else?
So that is a very good point, and that's what makes the diagnosis of Sjogren's so difficult, because so many things can cause dryness, and you hit several important features, on the nail on the head with them. So one is medication use. Two are common diseases like diabetes can cause dryness. Aging itself, which is all of us go through, causes dryness. Menopause causes dryness. Sleeping with your mouth open causes a dry mouth. And a lot of us actually don't fully close our eyelids at night. That causes dry eye. So what is real, how you distinguish them are to start off with those questions we talked about, severity. And sometimes your providers will help you. Like if your dentist notices you keep having cavities despite doing all the appropriate dental hygiene, if you've had that glands.
Wait, back to that. Why would you have more cavities if you have less saliva?
So your saliva actually is not static. It has a lot of very important antimicrobial features to it. So it has a lot of actual antibodies in it that fight off bacterial infection. And when you have an absence of saliva, and in Sjogren's, actually, your saliva, even if you have it, is abnormal, then you get proliferation of cavities. Despite brushing and doing all the flossing and all the hard work, a lot of our patients lose all their teeth.
Okay. And with the patients that you see with Sjogren's, and I think you're running one of the two big centers for Sjogren's in the Midwest, is that right?
Yeah, there are a few of us. Yeah. We're a small group.
Well, of all the patients that you see that have Sjogren's, do you find there's a big range, like a spectrum, where you might have somebody who has a little bit of Sjogren's and someone who has a severe case?
Absolutely. So the spectrum is broad. We call Sjogren highly heterogeneous. So it means each person can be very different from the next person how their Sjogren disease is. Most Sjogren patients have glandular involvement, meaning they have the dry eye, the dry mouth, usually some fatigue, and maybe some pain. And that's where at least 50% of patients sit. And we really focus on managing the dryness symptoms. My next job in that other 50% is understanding if they have organ involvement elsewhere, which organs can be involved. Commonly, it can be joints. But there are more dangerous manifestations, like we can get involvement of the lungs. We can get involvement of the nerves, both in the brain and in the extremities. We can get involvement of the gastrointestinal tract. We commonly get involvement of the kidneys, and that becomes why a rheumatologist has a role, right? So our job is to say, okay, once we find out an organ is involved, how do we manage it? And then we find the right specialist to work with us, because as much as I think I'm great, I am not a kidney expert, right? So I rely on my kidney colleagues. I rely on my neurology colleagues to co-manage that exact symptom with me under the umbrella of the Sjögren disease diagnosis.
And how do you know that the problem with the other organ is because of the Sjögren's, as opposed to just they have pneumonia and that's why the lungs are... I mean, how do you tell that it's Sjögren-induced or related?
That can be really hard, too. So there are distinct manifestations or involvement in that organ system that tend to be more commonly reported in Sjögren disease or not. For example, rash is common, but there are only certain rashes that are associated with Sjögren disease and not others. And so again, that's where you work with your specialist. Lung disease is really common in Sjögren. And when we have a Sjögren diagnosis and certain patterns of lung involvement, and I can go into what those patterns are, but our pulmonology team knows it very well, then we actually change our treatment algorithm compared to when it's a lung disease independent of any autoimmune process.
So if you are going to treat, and I know we're going to get to some of the more experimental and clinical trials and things you're working on now, but the standard treatment, you said, hasn't changed that much from when Dr. Sjögren found the first cases in the early 1900s or even before that. But what is the standard thing, just regular drops, or are there some more systemic medicines that are given out by rheumatologists now?
So the majority of treatments are symptom-based. So it's things for the eyes like drops. You can actually wear eye chambers around the eye that trap the moisture around the eye. You can...
What do you mean by eye chambers?
They're called... they're either called moisture chamber eyewear. And they essentially have a seal around them. And so you put in your eye drops and then you put on these either clear or opaque glasses, depending if it's night or day, and almost like a goggle. And it seals in the moisture in your local eye environment to prevent evaporation. So we can use instruments like that. We can plug the ducts that drain the tears. And that's done with your ophthalmologist. And then we do have some special inflammatory eye drops.
Wait a second. When you say plug the ducts, that seems counterintuitive. It seems like then you would have fewer tears if you're plugging the ducts.
Good question. So we have producing ducts that come from the lacrimal glands, and we have draining ducts that are in the inner corner of our eye. So our lacrimal glands live in the outer corner of our eye, and they give us tears from that direction. And in the inner corner of our eyes, we have these ducts that drain away tears. And just like a bathtub, we want to plug those drains because we want to keep the tears in. So we can fill up our bathtub with drops. We can cover it up to prevent evaporation, and we can plug the drain to prevent it, the tears from draining away. We have some topical anti-inflammatory drops we can use, but they have some limited efficacy. In the mouth, same thing. We have people chew sugar-free gum, but there can be adverse effects of using a lot of sugar-free products related to the gastrointestinal system. We can use wetting agents, and we can, this is our one systemic pill, is either sevimeline or pilocarpine, both of which are related to that Jaburandi plant that we referenced earlier.
That helps to create more moisture?
It does. So it helps you make more saliva. It doesn't work as well in the eyes. It unfortunately does carry a high frequency of side effects. So it makes your saliva go, but it can also help you sweat and make your stomach overwork too.
There's always the sort of side effects that come along with anything, it seems. What about lifestyle changes? Is there a relationship at all between diet and the symptoms of dry mouth or dry eye? In other words, do people with Sjögren's, are they advised to reduce salt intake, or are there certain foods that can make things worse? But I would think climate matters too, like if you're
yes.
in winter and things are not humidified, or, you know, I'm just curious about the lifestyle changes that can be recommended too.
You know, I just found out a close family friend of mine has Sjögren's. And she really didn't discover it until she moved to Colorado. The humidity is so low. So certainly the environment makes a difference. In terms of diet, we know less, but there are two ways of looking at this. One is common sense. So if your saliva is abnormal and you're going to form dental caries, you need to be really careful about sugar in the mouth. And if you do take in sugar, brushing and doing dental hygiene right afterwards, because remember, you can't clear the bacteria like a normal person can. The other way of looking at it is systemically, and we don't have a lot of data, and food trials are really difficult in general because controlling food intake is difficult. But I take a really common sense approach that we know that refined sugars and saturated fats can stimulate immune system pathways. And so I think a common sense diet of increasing fruits and veggies that don't have a lot of those refined sugars and saturated fats probably would be best for you. That being said, I don't strongly advise a dietary change because we don't have data to support that living, you know, a more, I think, rigorous dietary lifestyle would make a big difference in disease. If someone wants to control their diet, that's what I recommend, but I don't promote it as an independent factor. Exercise is also really important in Sjogren's disease. Our patients suffer from a lot of fatigue, and we have very few options for that right now. And one of the things we recommend is daily graded exercise, depending on your ability level.
So how would exercise help if it makes you sweat and, pant? Or I'm trying to picture the link between doing more exercise and then having, you know, alleviated symptoms.
So the exercise doesn't help dryness as much as the fatigue, and it's more about conditioning the body to deal with the autoimmunity. And it doesn't have to be anything that induces sweat. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be going out and jogging. It's graded with what you're able to do. So it's even taking a 30-minute walk outside. A lot of my patients like to swim. And so it's doing aerobic, water aerobic classes. It really is tailored to you as a patient and your physical ability. But it's about getting out and moving, conditioning your muscles to deal with this autoimmune process. It's almost like you have to prepare yourself for a battle on a daily basis.
What is the most severe case you've seen in terms of it, where it really affected quality of life?
So actually, they're sort of divergent in processes we think, how we think about it. Severity for patients is frequently symptom severity, how much this interferes in your day-to-day function. And that is what drives poor quality of life. And the symptom severity is severe dryness, fatigue, and can be pain too. And the symptoms are actually very difficult to treat. In contrast, a lot of rheumatologists and other specialists focus on the disease organ activity. So if you ask a doctor severity, we might think lung involvement, kidney involvement, but those features don't always actually interfere with quality of life. So they're sort of divergent concepts. And the therapies we're developing right now are typically most focused at the organ involvement. But our goal now is to move towards quality of life. And what is the most I've seen? I regularly see patients who say their Sjogren's markedly interferes with their day-to-day function and quality of life. I mean, imagine you're doing your radio show and you have to stop every 5 minutes because you can't talk anymore because you're so dry, right? And a lot of our patients can't swallow food items easily. So things we take for granted, seeing when you're driving, right? I take it all for granted. I never have to think about being able to see when I'm driving or reading the computer screen. But that really interferes in their day-to-day function.
I also read, maybe it was in one of the articles that you wrote or on the Mayo Clinic site talking about Sjogren's, that it can lead to brain fog. Why?
No idea. So actually, there are researchers trying to understand this right now, and I'm collaborating with them. We have some really exciting work we're doing. Why does Sjogren cause brain fog? I have no idea. It's probably related to the systemic immune response and inflammation. It might even be related to poor sleep because patients sleep well when they have to wake up at night to take sips of water or to put drops in their eye, or just because they're uncomfortable. When you chronically don't sleep well, that could relate to it. But actually, we're doing some really exciting work trying to understand why brain fog happens. And we're just about to kick off that study, I think, in the near future, hopefully.
We're going to talk about some of the groundbreaking studies that you have done that made national news when we return in a moment with University of the Air. Emily Auerbach, back with Dr. Sarah McCoy, and we are talking about an autoimmune disease called Sjogren's. You've made national news with some of the work you've done. Can you talk about some of your studies, the research you're doing, clinical trials?
Oh, thanks for asking about it. This is what drives my day-to-day desire to wake up in the morning. So we have a wet lab, and that lab focuses on mesenchymal.
Hold on. Wet lab.
Basic research lab. So we have a bench where we have a really excellent scientific team, and I have to just give a shout out to them because they work long hours every day to try to make the disease better. And it really is encouraging to see how passionate they are about making our understanding of the disease improve.
When you say wet lab, you're talking about a laboratory where you're looking at samples and...
On a bench. And a lot of those samples are from our Sjogren's disease patients, because my patients are just as enthusiastic about moving the needle forward as we are in our research team. So you're right. We're at an actual bench looking at patient samples, testing the patient samples, trying to understand why the disease occurs. Like I said, if we know more about the why, then we can tailor the therapy better in the future.
Because if you're just treating dry eyes and dry mouth, but you don't know why someone gets Sjogren's or sort of the root causes, is that what's kind of hindering treatment, is not understanding the mechanism?
That's exactly it. So we're much better at it now than we were. We do have a good understanding of basics. But remember earlier how I mentioned Sjogren's is heterogeneous and each person is really different? That actually hinders our understanding of the disease. So one of the things we've been doing is sort of taking bite-sized chunks of Sjogren's patients where we say, okay, if you're really similar, we group you together and we put similar likes together. And then if we study each of those groups of patients separately, we actually can find that they're driven by a slightly different process. And when we find out what's driving it that's a little bit different, then we can target it better. And so really, I think that probably Sjogren's patients should have more tailored therapy.
Do you think down the road there may be even a sort of split into different names for different groups, subgroups?
I hope so. I think it would do a good job with helping clinicians understand how to treat patients if they had a slightly different name or subgrouping of their disease.
Because I'm thinking of Alzheimer's, named after, you know, the Alzheimer's who found it, but there's so many different kinds of dementia, different reasons, different, you know. So that could be similar with whatever Dr. Sjogren's name is attached to, may not be the same thing ultimately. So when you have these samples, what is it you're looking for and finding? And why did it make national news?
Well, so we have two main branches of research in our lab. The one that really, I think, drove the latest news cycle was our understanding of mesenchymal stromal cells. What are those cells, right? So it's sort of... It's sort of difficult to describe, but you have in different tissues sort of this supportive tissue that supports, in the case of the glands, your epithelial cells. So what happens in the gland is your epithelial cells make the saliva or tears. And around those cells is a supportive tissue. And within that tissue are these stromal cells. We call them mesenchymal stromal cells. And their job is to make sure your epithelial cells function really well. And one of our research sort of directions is to understand how that goes wrong in Sjogren's disease and how we can harness the attributes of, just in general, stromal cells to treat local disease. And we recently, what made the news was our first in world clinical trial injecting marrow derived. So we took from bone marrow instead of from glands, these stromal cells, and injected them into the glands that make the most saliva.
So this is stem cells.
Correct.
That you're adding, where you're hoping by adding it, it will kind of repair something or make it work better, because...
I wouldn't do it if that weren't the hope. But what we hope happens is that when we inject those MSCs, is what we call them, and stem is sort of what you might call it on the street, but it's, I like to call them mesenchymal stromal cells, so MSCs. We inject those guys in the glands, and what we think they do is they give off growth factors and anti-inflammatory factors that promote healing of the epithelium that is acting badly in Sjogren's disease.
Would it have the same effect if you tried it on a lupus patient? I mean, in other words, is what you're doing with Sjogren's something that could be replicated in other autoimmune diseases, but you're just happening to do the research on Sjogren's? Or is it looking at some sort of unique feature of Sjogren's itself?
So what was unique about this study was not only how we prepared our stem cells before injection, but that we gave them locally. So we gave them into the salivary gland where, so the patients we selected were severely dry, and that was their primary symptom. There are studies in lupus ongoing right now that do systemic MSC injections. And those trials have yet to be, the results of them have yet to be published. Indeed, in Sjogren's in out of China years ago, they did a systemic injection of MSCs, and they reported really promising results. But this is unique in that we, one, the source of our MSCs, how we treat them, and then that we do local injection to minimize any adverse effects and hopefully to maximize the benefit, because they should actually last longer when you inject them locally than if you inject them through the IV.
And how many patients are you working with in order to get a significant result?
So our goal is we have to first, so we have two major salivary glands that we're injecting that make 80% of our saliva, and they live below our chin. And our first goal is just to show that if we inject one side, it can be safe. And this is, again, the FDA is wants to make sure everything we do is very safe. So in six patients, we'll inject just one side, and we're going to do three Sjogren disease patients and three graft versus host disease patients, who are also patients who suffer from severe dryness, but because their transplant is attacking their own self. Once we show that it's safe, then we move on to a true phase one trial where we inject both glands. And our goal is to recruit around 20 patients to that study. But each of these steps requires funding. And so that is my main job, is to get funding for each of those steps.
And do you have to have a sort of placebo or blind control kind of thing where...
So that will come in our later phase studies. So our first, we have to prove that we're safe, which we're pretty confident that the therapy, because it comes from your own body, will be safe. And then when we look at proving efficacy, that's where it's important to have a control arm.
If the results prove positive, where it does seem to help, when would you know that?
Science moves slowly. So my guess is at least in the order of years. My hope would be before the decade ends, we could have a whole clinical trial set up. But it takes a long time to do clinical trials.
What kinds of work is being done in terms of drug treatments?
That is a good question. So in general, the field is moving very quickly right now. And I would call it almost a paradigm shift. And the reason is, to date, we've had no effective FDA-approved disease-modifying therapies, none. And so when you go to a doctor and you say, I have Sjogren's disease, they may say, I can't treat you. So, you know, you may be dismissed because they can't do anything to intervene. But that is about to change. So we have had lots of failed trials in Sjogren's disease. We are masters of failure. But recently, we've had some great successes. And this has really been in just the past few years. We have clinical trials meeting their phase two primary endpoints. And we anticipate the first phase three trial to be done within a year, showing an effective first Sjogren's disease therapy. And that is crazy.
How many phases are there? Is phase three the last part?
The phase three is the last one.
Okay, so after phase three of the clinical trial, then it would be ready for a drug company to do something to market it or?
To market, so hopefully the FDA will approve it. There are some question marks we have. Who will it be approved for? You know, will the first drug therapy apply to all Sjogren's patients? But we discuss our different kinds of Sjogren's patients. So will it only apply to some? We don't know. But certainly it's exciting because it means that we can potentially change the trajectory of the disease for the first time.
It wouldn't be a cure, but it would be a treatment that would effectively handle the symptoms, or?
None of our known therapies and autoimmunity in general cure the disease that we know of yet. We have some therapies that give us some hope, but for now it's remission is our goal. And what is remission in Sjogren's disease? We don't know that yet because we haven't had the luxury of having a therapy that we thought works.
In some cases, when there's a rare disease, the drug companies won't produce or market it because they can't make enough of a profit, or the cost of the treatment is so high. Is Sjogren's common enough that when there is a drug that gets past the phase three and is ready, Is Sjogren's common enough that a drug therapy will be produced?
So I think a good mark would be rheumatoid arthritis. Most of us think Sjogren's disease is a little less common than rheumatoid arthritis. And rheumatoid arthritis has been heavily developed by pharmaceutical companies in terms of therapeutics, and they've, I think, been able to turn a profit. And because Sjogren's is about as common as rheumatoid arthritis, I would presume that they have done the market research and would move forward with most of these drugs. Now, that being said, some have competing mechanisms, meaning they work kind of similarly. And so companies may not move forward with drugs in the developmental process if one comes out first that's already similar to the drug they're developing. But other than that, I think that in general, the feeling I'm getting is that they are quite enthusiastic. There are enough patients where they can make a profit margin that would warrant development of the drugs.
You mentioned before we started this conversation, when we were just getting ready for it, that you're on the board of a Sjogren's Foundation, I think it is, and that they do a good job. Can you talk a little bit about resources for people who want to learn more?
The Sjogren Foundation is an excellent resource for patients if they want good sourced information that comes usually from either known research or experts in the field. You know, the people who run that foundation are passionate, and many or most have Sjogren disease. So they really care about the patient and they really listen to our patients. So they have a great website. You can go onto their website and you'll be able to easily see the work they're doing, what their current areas of research that they're trying to push are. They provide grant funding. So I've had grants through Sjogren Foundation, and others have. They really encourage young investigators to go into Sjogren disease. And then they also have resources like product guides. So as we discussed, a lot of what we use is topical, symptomatic, and they have a bunch of examples of different products you can try that patients have found helpful.
And Sjogren's, if you're just listening and can't see the word, is spelled S-J. Oh, with a funny, umlaut or something, G-R-E-N, Sjogren, from the Swedish ophthalmologist that first noticed quite a few women patients that had this severe dryness of the eyes and salivary glands and so on. And what do you hope, if you imagine being interviewed 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what do you hope that you'll know then that you don't know now?
I hope for the first time we have a therapy that can halt or slow the disease process, something that can give our patients hope that we can make an intervention and make their disease better. I hope we've developed a curative cell therapy. That would be a dream come true. And I hope that when patients come to clinic, we can give promise that there is a better future for the symptoms that drive them into our clinic in the first place.
Can you, I'm also assuming that in 5-10 years, you'll have a better sense of all the different kinds of Sjogren's that don't seem to, you know, you keep saying it's heterogeneous, that there are many different kinds. Can you give us some sense a little bit more of the different types of Sjogren's you're seeing?
Right. So this is an evolving area of research again, and most of what I'm talking about is in motion. And so it will move onward and we'll gain knowledge and we'll know more. But right now, we call these different types of Sjogren disease endotypes, or, what's driving them are similar, and it leads to a similar end product, or not end product, but end person, I guess, would be the would be the way to say it. And when we stratify them, there are different ways of doing it. And so this will change over time. But I think one of the exciting ways of looking at this is in a disease-specific way. And so, for example, one of the recent studies said, okay, well, I think there are roughly three kinds. There are different ways of doing this, but there are roughly three kinds of Sjogren disease. And one group is really interesting because they get disease onset a little earlier, and they actually don't have as many symptoms, but one of their immune cells is highly active. And those patients tend to go on to get more severe organ involvement. Their symptoms also tend to get worse over time, too. And why that is helpful to us is that by identifying this group, if I see them in clinic, I can tell them what their disease is more likely to look like. In contrast, if I see a patient who's a little older, who has already lung involvement, nerve involvement, their disease tends to get a little bit better over time. And this is in broad strokes, just generalizations. And then certain groups of patients, the ones who come in with really high symptom burden, they don't tend to change as much over time. And so all of this can help me tell the patient what to expect, because I think it's really frustrating. There's so many unknowns for patients. But when I have papers and studies like this, I can say, okay, I think you're in this group. I've done your lab testing. I can classify you in this group. This is where I think your disease might go over the next 5 years. And that's been really helpful and hopefully will evolve in a more refined way so I can tell patients even more about what to expect.
I assume, too, there might be development of new diagnostic tests that are less intrusive than like a lip biopsy or some of the things with eyes. You know, we were talking about how we used to have to spit into a cup for a COVID test, and now it's evolved to like a home test that you can do. With the diagnostic part of Sjogren's, do you see new advances, if you picture 5-10 years from now, in terms of how that might be easier and less intrusive to diagnose?
Yeah, so there are two things I'd want to say about that. One is that as it stands, the biopsy is the gold standard for those who are SSA negative. And it can be really tricky because you have to find someone to do the biopsy of the lip, which sounds odd, but you know, I have a YouTube video up, and in the comments, one guy or lady says, you know, one time I bit my lip really hard and these glands came out and now I know what they are. So it's actually something you could accidentally do too. But it's really tricky because you have to find someone to do it. And then it actually is very difficult to interpret. So much so that if you have a general pathologist look at it, about half of the diagnoses will be revised when it's looked at by an expert. So that's a big change in diagnosis, just if you have one pathologist versus someone who's really experienced look at the same biopsy. And so there are a lot of tricks associated with that biopsy, but we don't have other options now. That being said, one of our major goals is to develop a simple blood test or a simple test out of saliva that could tell us these patients have Sjogren's disease without the need for biopsy. And that's actually another area of research that I'm involved in. And we did identify an antibody candidate to identify a subset of those patients, for which we're moving forward to validate and develop a panel. And hopefully in the next 1 to 2 years, we can have a new test out to help alleviate the need for biopsy. But as it stands, in some patients, that's the only way to get a diagnosis.
If somebody said to you, I don't have Sjogren's, I don't know anyone who has it, why should I care about this? What would you say?
Well, I think that first it's empathizing with the people who do have it, because a large number are walking around and you can't see the disease. It's hard to see. But just because you can't see it on the outside doesn't mean that they aren't afflicted and their day-to-day function is impaired. And I think that's the case in many diseases, right? The silent chronic diseases you can't see. And I think that especially when we have no effective therapies, it's important to understand these patients, you know, could have productive lives, interactions with their family, social interactions that they lack now that we could provide for them, and they would have a better quality of life and be a functional member of society, which is always one of our many goals.
Thank you so much for opening our eyes, our dreamy eyes, to Sjogren's. My guest has been Dr. Sarah McCoy. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.